We are looking at intelligent design today, and we'll get into what the definition is, what it means in a bit. But I did want to provide a little information in regards to why I believe this issue of intelligent design is important, especially today. So some of you, Bungie mentioned, some of you may have heard of or actually watched the recent debate between Ken Ham, who is a creationist, and Bill Nye, who's a science spokesperson, as it were, per se. And the debate that they had, that they participated in, was over the question of whether Ken Ham's creation model was viable as a scientific model. That was a specific question of the debate. And just as Bungie mentioned, a little bit of disappointment where he wished Ken Ham would have driven the point home, I share the same amount of frustration where it seemed that both Bill Nye and Ken Ham did not really concentrate. In fact, they didn't talk about the question at hand. They really had prepared presentations, and they provided good info, but it really wasn't over that specific debate question. So I was a little frustrated, and I was like, man. But It was clear just by the fact, the virtue of that debate and what kind of coverage it had. It had nationwide coverage. I mean, some of you might remember the Scopes trial, or heard about the Scopes trial, and how that kind of drove a lot of what culture thought about Christians at the time, about evolution, about creation, about the Bible, stuff like that. And so this one was similar. It drew a lot of interest. And obviously, as Christians, we believe that the universe and the life within it was created. Genesis 1:1, right at the outset. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God created. So we have it right out there. Colossians 1:17, I believe, speaks about how it was through Jesus that the universe was created, that we were created not only by him, but for him. So there's purpose involved in creation. We're meant as living beings, as created in God's image, we're meant not only just to live our lives, but we're meant to live it for him. We're meant to know him and have a relationship with him. So when a belief comes along that seems to deny or do away with the need for a creator, there is a need to respond. I think we all would agree with this. Now, we could spend the entire class time reviewing the debate, but I don't think we want to do that, and we won't do that today. I did want to point out one issue that I noticed, that a common theme throughout the debate, and this is something that both gentlemen did for the most part, and they did well for the most part, but they could have improved this at certain moments during the debate. And the issue is defining terms. All right, this is a debate, and I feel that in some parts of the debate they failed to define terms, and it just led to confusion. Defining term, what I mean by that is, I'm defining terms, is basically clarifying what a certain word means. I think it's obvious just from even saying defining terms. And this is so important in a debate setting, for sure, but imagine this is how much more important it would be on an individual level when we're having evangelistic conversations. And I think we could all agree on this, because it's easy to think of a case where two people, let's say you're in an evangelistic conversation here, and this may have happened to you. So you're discussing two sides of a subject where you disagree on, right? And then because of the failure to define terms, the conversation quickly degenerates into an argument. Simply because both people thought they were going on assumed definitions, different definitions of certain words they were using, and it just caused chaos. It caused confusion, and it led to this outbreak of an argument. For example, I'll give you one specific one. When conversing with a Mormon, we could let them know that salvation is found only in Jesus, and we're encouraging them, put your faith in Jesus. But they would respond, you know, I agree. Salvation is found only in Jesus. Well, you might be caught aback. You might be thrown aback, and well, what's going on? I'm caught by surprise here. Well, the distinction here is that, or the problem is, there's very different definitions being used on both sides. And there's an importance there to ask your Mormon friend, well, what exactly do you mean when you say salvation found in Jesus? And you'll see, it's a very different definition. So if we're not careful in defining our terms, it can become very frustrating. And so I think we probably have all had an experience like that, so I don't want to belabor the point too much. Now, I'm mentioning this idea of clarifying terms for two reasons. I think it's going to be helpful, and it's going to be relevant to our discussion today. First, we know that when we know the importance of defining terms, which I think we all do, I would want to encourage you then, as a result, to make it a point to, in evangelistic conversations, or any conversation, really, clarify what certain terms mean, certain Christian terms. I don't know if you've ever heard the terminology Christianese. You know, in Christian circles like this, we tend to assume that everybody knows what certain terminology we use, like salvation, the gospel, stumbling block, glorification, sanctification, stuff like that. And we just assume, oh yeah, they know. You know, especially in Christian circles. But my issue is, what I want to point out is that if we become accustomed to only using those terms, especially in these Christian circles, the issue is that when we go out then and have evangelistic conversations, and these are the only kinds of terms that we can use, that we know how to use, that we're used to using, you'll find very quickly, I believe, that you'll be caught with blank stares, with confusing stares. They're like, glorification, sanctification, how does that relate to my life? I have no idea what these words mean. And so it can become confusing. So I want to encourage you is, when you're in these types of conversations, make a conscious effort to begin defining these terms. So when you say, salvation is found in Jesus, or Jesus came to die for your sins. And what I mean by sin is, and then you go ahead and explain it. Salvation. What I mean by salvation is, think about it this way. You know, you want to define your terms. So you can accomplish that by asking, also you can also ask the person what they believe these words to mean. It's a simple tactic. What do you think I mean when I use this word? And you can clarify after they respond. Secondly, and I find this more effective actually, is learn to use alternative, easy to understand words and phrases. So one of my favorite ones, phrases that I've kind of started replacing in normal conversation is the word faith. Now, don't look at me like I'm a heretic or anything like that. What I mean by that is in the New Testament, that word faith is simply rendered trust. It means trust. And so I'll use that when discussing, having evangelistic conversations. I'm like, put your trust in Jesus. Because I know that in today's culture, as soon as I utter the word faith, all these negative connotations come up in that person's mind, meaning blind faith, blind leap in the dark, and they think I believe stuff without having the evidence. But when I use the word trust, immediately they know, oh, you only trust things that are trustworthy. And so they don't have all this baggage that comes along with it. So I think it's more effective. You can try it out. But learn to use alternative phrases and words for the common Christianese, the common Christian terms. All right. You know, one way that you can even learn to do this, get on a fast route to learning to use easier words is by participating in the youth group. We're always looking for sermons, guys. That's my plug. All right. Yeah, shameless plug. Maybe a little shame. Now, deep breath. How does this relate to our discussion on intelligent design today? Well, the subject of intelligent design is related to the subject of evolution. And I can guarantee that as soon as I finished even uttering the word evolution just now, everyone in here just conceptualized what they believe evolution to mean. And I bet you that meaning, that individual meaning you had, is probably different than a lot of people's in here. All right. Now imagine taking your definition of evolution into an evangelistic conversation without having clarified terms. What would you expect to happen? I think there would be confusion right off the bat. With that said, I'd like to begin our discussion of ID. That's why I'm going to say shorten intelligent design, ID. I want to clarify this term, evolution. And I believe this will be helpful in two ways. First, it's going to help us to gain a better understanding of the issue of evolution in general, which obviously will lead to less confusion on our part. With a clear definition, we'll be able to take what we see in culture and draw an educated conclusion. So whenever we see a commercial or a movie, especially, this concept of evolution is becoming big in box office hits. Or whenever you listen to a radio interview, what have you. Many examples. Now, if you have a clearer understanding of what evolution actually is, you'll be able to say, huh, well, it seems to me that they're using this word in an incorrect manner. Or, there's some big ideas being presented here. What are some conclusions that I can draw as a result? And remember, we're called to love God with our mind. We don't want to simply rely on secondhand knowledge for everything. So if we're just relying on some secondhand definition of evolution that we picked up a long time ago and we never really bothered to look into it, I think we're doing a disservice to the Lord at that point. We're not really honoring Him with our mind. And this is not only in theology, guys. I do believe you don't want to rely on people's secondhand theology. Do theology yourself. Study the scriptures. At the same time, cultural matters as well. Understanding the big issues. Evolution is one of them. So we're called to grow in knowledge and love God with all our mind. Let's cultivate that life of the mind. A second way I think it's going to help when we clear up the definition of evolution, it's going to help in our evangelistic conversations. You see the theme running here. You'd be surprised, guys, or maybe not, how many people say they believe in evolution, and yet when I ask, what do you mean by evolution? It becomes clear that they do not know what they're talking about, you know? And at that point, I would have an opportunity to clear away some of that confusion and perhaps cause them to even question their superficial belief in evolution as a result. Now, up to this point, I've not had someone turn away from evolution as a result, but I believe it's because of other reasons, which we'll discuss later on in the study. Now, let's talk about what evolution is, finally. Sigh of relief. Now, I'd like to hear your input, okay? So I'm gonna write some things on the board. I'd like to hear your input. How would you define evolution? I want to get like two or three responses. I want to write them on the board, and we'll keep them up there. Don't all raise your hands at once.
Dinosaurs.
Okay, I'll put dinosaurs up here. The question is, how would you define evolution, okay? Yeah.
How the earth was created.
How earth was created. Anyone else?
How life came about.
Yeah.
Okay. Was created. Anyone else?
It's a process of change.
Yeah.
Species development over time. I don't even know.
Process of change. What did you say though?
Process
of change. Clark said. Species.
Species.
Macro or...
Are we talking about macro or microevolution?
No, that's good. I mean, this is relevant to the conversation. I'm just going to put it up as you said it. And then you said single cell...
To where it's present.
Okay, I'll put SC to present. Okay.
You got to throw the big bang in there. It'll pop.
You want to throw a big bang in there?
Big bang.
Sure.
Boom.
Big bang, boom. Bada bing, bada boom.
Bing bang. That's what you put.
Bing bang.
No, that's really what you put.
Did I? Thank you. All right. So, we'll keep these definitions in mind, okay? These are all the thoughts that came up in your guys' minds as to what, whenever we say evolution, this automatically pops up, right? And just like I predicted, right? Entirely different results from each individual. This is cool. Now, I want to look at, before we get into what the common definition when we're talking about intelligent design, when it relates to that, I want to talk first about, there's different meanings of evolution that have kind of been discussed throughout the years. And one of them is, in fact, this change over time. Process of change over time. That's a very broad definition of evolution that's been passed throughout the centuries or the years. And I don't think we really have any disagreement with that. We know there's change. You know, over the past month, I've probably gained 5 pounds. I've changed, you know? There's a process of change, and it's over time. One is the idea of common ancestry. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. That might be a new term, and I'll explain it real quick. Common ancestry basically says that every single living organism alive today descended ultimately from one common ancestor. And usually we would say that it's a single-celled organism. So that's up there too, single cell to present. That's common ancestry. And then one more popular meaning of the meaning of evolution is a term called natural selection. Natural selection. And in fact, this is the one that we want to concentrate on today as it relates in, to ID. So I'll get into what that means in a little bit. And by a little bit, I mean right now. So let's describe the main definition of evolution that we'll be using. Actually, I want to take a step back, and I do want to address what Larry brought up, this Big Bang. There are different... So what we're talking about specifically as it relates to ID is biological evolution. Bio meaning life, logic, study of life. You took a biology course probably in high school. That's biological evolution, all this common ancestry, single cell organism, blah, blah, natural selection. There's such a thing known as, I guess, astronomical evolution or geological evolution. So these different studies of evolution, for instance, astronomical or cosmological evolution or something like that would be when you look out into space and you want to understand how the planets and galaxies came about and how they have changed over time. Same thing with geological. We want to see the Grand Canyon. We want to see how that changes over time and how it could have come about in the first place, stuff like that. So yes, Big Bang is relevant to evolution in a very broad sense of change over time. But today we want to concentrate on biological evolution. And so now let's get to our main definition of evolution. We did mention this broader definition that species can change. And I believe it was Clark that mentioned one species giving rise to another. So kind of a changing of species to species. And this relates to what Lowell brought up. Are we talking about macro or microevolution? I'm not sure how many of you have heard of these terms, macro or micro. So I'll just give a brief definition. Microevolution is basically talking about changes within a species. For instance, the famous example would be Darwin's finches. So Charles Darwin noticed doing his studies that during different seasons of the year, the finch's beak, it's a bird, their beak changed in length. And the idea was that, I guess, during the colder, I forget which seasons, but their beak would change in length in order to adapt to what environment. So if the little critters that they were trying to get within a bark or something were deep inside there, you know, he noticed that there was an adaptation in their beak length to get longer to try to reach those critters that were further back. And then when these critters would start coming closer to the surface, he noticed that another adaptation where their beaks started getting smaller. And this is microevolution. This is changes within a species. Their beak changed, but you wouldn't call the longer beak finch a different species than a shorter beaked one. It's the same bird, it just has a longer beak. And I think we understand that because our ears never stop growing throughout our lifetime. So, you know, we're going to have long ears when we're super old, right? That's microevolution. We don't become a different species as a result.
Long-eared
human. Yeah. I don't know what Latin for long ears, but add that to Homo sapien. There's no disagreement over that. The macroevolution, on the other hand, says there are large-scale changes then that lead from you have one species at one certain point in time, and there's large changes that happen over a certain amount of time, which leads to creation or bringing about of an entirely different species, that you have to create a different species name for it. That's macro, and that's the definition where the controversy comes in, okay? So good point in bringing that up. All right, getting back to our main definition here about evolution.
Could you give an example of the macroevolution within a species to species?
Going from one species to another?
Yeah.
Sure. So The popular one that you'll see being thrown out is that humans, us, Homo sapiens, at one point in time evolved from an ape-like creature. Whether it be like a chimpanzee, they would say that the gorillas or those kinds of apes are cousins. They're not necessarily what we're descended from. But we descended from an ape-like creature. So you imagine going out in the jungle, you find a chimpanzee or something, they would say, oh, these are our forefathers. And so there was changes throughout the generations of these ape-like creatures, and these changes in skull, size, and just the bone structure and genetic mutations that led to the creation of a human body over a long period of time. So that's one specific example.
Is it the same as like primate or caveman?
I guess caveman would be kind of further along the line, that would be closer to us. In fact, it would probably be us, but there were still changes going on at that point. That's one specific example. And we can talk after about more examples that are popular in culture today. All right, main definition. Here it is. That humans are descended from non-human ancestors with modification. And that's what we just talked about. Humans are descended from non-human ancestors with modification. And that's actually one part of the definition. Another part would be that not just humans, but every species on Earth is descended from a single common ancestor. Notice that term we just brought in, common ancestry. Every species on Earth is descended from a single common ancestor. Now, at this point, I think is where the majority of people would stop with their definition of evolution. Oh, you're telling me that to believe in evolution, where it's molecules to man, from goo to you by way of the zoo, and they think that it's just this simple process of change over time, that somehow it's just magically going to happen. Well, that's only half of the story of evolution. And remember, I mentioned, I think that's where the majority of people would stop. The other half is missing, and the other half is the very important one, because this other half is what Charles Darwin actually brought forth as a theory, not the theory of evolution. The theory of evolution was already around during Darwin's time. What he brought about was what we call the theory of natural selection. So remember I mentioned the different meanings, and we stopped on natural selection. And this is the second half of the theory of, I guess, what we would call today Darwinian evolution. Because what Darwin did with this theory of natural selection is he noticed that things change over time. But he, with this theory of natural selection, theorized the mechanism of how a species can evolve into a different species. He was answering the how question. How can a species evolve to another? And he proposed this theory of natural selection. And natural selection says that... I'll give an example, actually. So imagine... let's butt it up against artificial selection. You might have heard this. And this is popular with breeders, okay? So, say you are a shepherd, and you want to get a very woolly breed of sheep, okay? What would you do at this point? Let's say you have a bunch of sheep, all right? At this point, what you would do is you have your little pen of sheep, and you see which ones are the wooliest from this group, right? They're not all the same. You see, which one are the wooliest? And hopefully they're male, female. You breed them, and that they have wooly genes, basically. It's in their genes. And by artificial selection, you actually pick them out, made them breed, and the next generation then would be wooly. And you continue to do that on down the line, and 3-4 generations down the line, you have this really, really wooly breed of sheep. That's artificial selection. Now, Darwin, what he proposed at the time, he says, you know what? How is it, can nature do this alone? He says, I could imagine of imagine of a situation where, let's say, a very cold winter killed out all of the less woolly sheep. So it was just cold winter. It was nature occurring. And now only the woolly sheep have survived. And so they breed, and the next generation breeds a woollier breed of sheep. And he says, in this way, I can see how natural selection, nature, is kind of weeding out the organisms that do not fit the environment. And so those that survive then go ahead and pass on their genes to the next generation when they reproduce. And these genetic, the genetic information then goes into the next generation and so on and so forth. And so whatever the environment, whatever the climate is at the time, it'll rule out some species, some organisms, and whatever survives, whatever is fit for the environment, is able to reproduce and pass on their genetic information to the next generation. So Darwin at this point, I mean, it was a very simple, common sense idea, but he was the one to actually put it forth. Theory of natural selection, how nature can actually kind of do the work of what an artificial selector would do, but there's no need for any outside help. And so he put forth this theory of natural selection. It was very ingenious. I mean, even his colleague Thomas Huxley said, I'm so stupid, how could I have not thought about this? And so very simple, very ingenious idea, and it caught on. And so what that did, though, is just in the very title of it, natural selection, is it rules out the idea of having any outside help. It's just natural. It's not artificial. It's natural. And so, of course, that's where a lot of flags were raised. Well, if there's no outside help, the common theory or common knowledge at the time was that, yeah, God is the one who creates and sustains. There is no change in form. So he disrupted the environment greatly with this theory of natural selection. But that's the second half that a lot of people miss. So when we say evolution, what we really mean to say is evolution through natural selection. Because evolution is just the change over time part. Natural selection is the how, the mechanism through which you get the changes over time that lead to different species actually being created. All right. Hopefully you guys can condense that into some note forms. All right. So that's how we would want to define evolution in the greater debate, the greater conversation that's happening around in culture today. And I think it's even just the knowledge that you have now, this second half of the story, the natural selection, I think a lot of people that you get in conversations with would be surprised with that portion, okay? So how do we define intelligent design? If you jump on the website, intelligentdesign.org, you'll find the proper definition, and this is it. Certain features of the universe and living things are best explained by an intelligent cause and are not the result of an undirected, chance-based process such as natural selection. Let me say that one more time. Certain features of the universe and living things are best explained by an intelligent cause and are not the result of an undirected, chance-based process such as natural selection. So you can see right here that it immediately contradicts. Yeah, one more time.
What's the website you got that from?
And who said that?
Yes, this is from the intelligentdesign.org. And I guess I'll just mention this right away, is that one leading proponent of intelligent design is this Dr. Stephen C. Meyer. Stephen Meyer. He's a philosopher of science, and he's one of the leading proponents of intelligent design. There's other people such as Michael Behe, William Dembski, Philip Johnson, Charles Thaxton. So all these people kind of started bringing up these ideas, and now it's coalesced into this official kind of statement about what intelligent design is. So I'll repeat it one more time here. Certain features of the universe and living things are best explained by an intelligent cause and are not the result of an undirected, chance-based process such as natural selection. And feel free to get with me after if you need the rest of the definition. But you can see, like I was mentioning, it directly contradicts this Darwinian version of evolution by natural selection. It even says, not natural selection. But I did want to point out, guys, that the theory of intelligent design, this concept of intelligent design, it is not a religious argument. Nowhere in this definition did we mention God. It says intelligent cause, but it did not mention God. There's a distinction, and it's crucial. It is not a religious doctrine. It is also not an interpretation of the Genesis text. It has nothing to say about whether the story, the account given in Genesis 1 and 2 are true or not, or how we interpret that. It says nothing about that. Yes?
So is Meyer a Christian?
Yes. And but this is, I'll mention this, this is kind of the beauty of intelligent design is that this is what I was ultimately getting to. Even though it's a science-based theory, it does have religious implications. It is not a religious theory trying to explain who God is. There are plenty of Christian proponents of intelligent design, Stephen Meyer being one of them, William Dembski, and I would say Michael Behe, I think. But obviously, you notice my hesitation. There are also non-Christian and even atheistic and agnostic supporters of intelligent design. One of them being Michael Berlinski. Great speaker. But they notice that there's flaws within Darwinian evolution, but they also notice that there's good arguments on the side of ID. So it doesn't matter. You don't have to be a Christian to uphold intelligent design. So it's religiously neutral is what I'm getting at. And why I say this is when you're in conversations with skeptics, they'll immediately just try to brush off intelligent design because they'll just try to say, oh, that's just creationism in cheap tuxedo. You know, I don't want to hear that. That's not science. And say, they just try to brush it off just by equating it with a religious doctrine. You can say, whoa, whoa, tell me where in this definition can you find God? Well, you're just trying to prove God. Well, there's a difference between an argument from religion and a scientific argument with religious implications. There's no explanation about who or what the intelligent cause is. Obviously, we would be biased and say God, but in the proper definition, there is no mention of God. So as it stands, it is a good definition. It is religiously neutral, and I think it is very forceful in the scientific realm as a result. Do you guys get the distinction there? Are there any questions on that?
Yeah, can you repeat it all again?
Yeah. I'll mention the main part. It is a scientific theory with religious implications, not a religious theory. And so this is actually Darwin's legacy that he left, this theory of natural selection. And it's kind of caught motion, it's got momentum, especially in today's culture. And what's funny, though, is that there's this understanding that biological organisms are very complex. So even though they deny the creator, or they would deny the conclusion of a creator or an intelligent cause, no doubt, I would say every scientist would agree that these biological organisms are complex and they do give off the appearance of design. In fact, Richard Dawkins, he's a noted atheist, he mentioned in one of his books, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And if you know Richard Dawkins, this is, I don't know how he even put this in a book. He had time to think about it and edit it, and it wound up coming in the book. But he says he understands there is an appearance of design. Granted, he would conclude that ultimately the appearance is not real design. Real design is illusory when you ultimately look at these organisms. And that's the question that we're gonna ask: is there a way to determine if there's real design in these biological organisms? And that's the ultimate question we want to get at, and that's what ID is going to try to show. And so we'll actually take a break here before we continue on. So this is our intermission. But I guess I did want to mention one thing before we take the break. Notice I didn't say ID is going to prove that there's a designer. And I'm very careful in using that word proof or prove, especially in having an evangelistic context. Because so many times I know I've had a skeptic ask me, well, prove to me God exists. And most of the time, if you ask him, what do you mean by proof? What do you mean by prove? They're looking for mathematical certainty. They're looking for 100% certainty. There cannot be any ounce of doubt. And to that, I just respond to them, well, then you would have to throw out a lot of your beliefs. I mean, how do you know that your mom loves you? Are you 100% certain? You know, how do you know that we're not just brains in a vat? Are you 100% certain? This would affect greatly the way I live my life. And so what I like to show or use the phrase is, what is the best explanation? Or do we have evidence to show that we are reasonable in believing these things? And I don't think also that it doesn't take away from our deeply held faith in God and Jesus. Remember, we're using that word faith. It means trust. I mean, obviously, we don't have a complete knowledge about God or about the history of Christianity. But I can still put my trust in God. I can still put my trust in Jesus. I don't have proof, but I have good reasons to believe so. So I would encourage you, be a little bit leery of using the word proof, or when somebody comes in and tries to attack you and ask you for proof. I say, whoa, I think that's a little bit too strong. Even you wouldn't accept your definition, right? So ID is going to give the best explanation, I think. All right, so far we've discussed definitions and given some background information on Darwin and his theory of natural selection, but this one question still stands. Is every appearance, let me rephrase that and emphasize a different word, is every appearance of design in biology, as Richard Dawkins said, the result of an undirected process? For example, many of you may be familiar with Darwin's, or the tree of life in general. And this was supposed to explain or give a visual depiction of how we can visualize the common ancestry. And so you start out with the trunk of... This is a horrible marker. So you start off with... That was not good either.
They're all good.
I think this one was good. Yep. You start off with the trunk of the tree. And as it goes up, you know, you have one branch here. And it might branch out again over here. You have another branch over here. Different branch. And so these breaks in the branches, and I mean, it could get into this humongous tree, right? These breaks in the branches represent a break in species or a creation of a new species. In fact, you know what? Let me just give in and use this. Here's the branch, and this would be the simplest form of life, okay? And as time is in the y-axis, as time progresses, you see these different branches coming out of the tree stump. And each break in the branch, I can't reach it, but let me use this handy-dandy laser. What?
It's the biggest laser I've ever seen in my life.
Thank Edith. Boom. And it's not visible, of course. How could I have not thought about that?
Do you want me to get up there and point?
Each break in the branches represents an entirely new species. But you notice, as you come down the branch, the smaller branches are descended from the lower branches. And so these represent from a more simpler form of life, and it grows into more and more complex forms of life and more species. This is a visual depiction of the theory of evolution by natural selection, and it results in this tree of life, all descended from one common ancestor, which is that stump of the tree. Okay?
It's a little bit more elaborate than Darwin's original sketch.
Yes. Yes, but for purposes here, we can envision what evolution is visually, okay?
What about the roots of those canyons?
Yeah, the roots are unknown at this point.
Subterranean.
Yeah. Whatever's simpler than a single-celled organism. Okay. Now, what we want to do today, though, is remember we're asking the question, does every appearance of design in biology represent or brought about by an undirected process? Every appearance of design. And so we saw the tree of life, but the stump of the tree represents a single-celled organism. Okay? But what we're going to do today with intelligent design, we're going to push the question one step further. We're not going to look at just a single-celled organism. In fact, we're going to look at the origin of life itself. Something that is, how does the single-celled organism even come about in the first place? Okay? So remember, we did this with the moral argument, we did this with the theological argument, teleological, and the cosmological. We always went back to the fundamental issue. This only explains how already reproducing species evolve into more species. But Darwin had nothing to say in his book, Origin, on the Origin of Species. He had nothing to say about the matter of the origin of life. And people have put it, it explains the survival of the fittest, but not the arrival of the fittest. And so that's, we're going to take, push that question back. Can we recognize design at this point in history, at the origin of life? And it'll be helpful to know that back then, in Darwin's time at least, there was a very simplistic understanding of the cell back in that day. So it was almost that there was no felt need to even provide an explanation for the origin of life. They thought of the cell as something similar to what Jell-O would be, just this kind of globule of protoplasm. It was similar to a texture like Jell-O, and they just thought, yeah, we could conceive of life, you know, being produced just a couple different chemicals, a little lightning, voila, you have a cell. And it reproduces after that, and we have this tree here. But that was a very simplistic understanding, and as time went on, even up to the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, our understanding of the inner workings of the cell grew exponentially up until the point where we discovered DNA. And that's where we're going to concentrate our argument on, DNA. All right, I do want to show you, now that we're talking about DNA, I want to show you a quick video where Stephen Meyer, he's doing a lecture, and he's going to show us the basic workings of DNA and how it produces proteins, which are the basic building blocks of life. And don't worry about understanding all of the science and all of the biology and all that. I just want to show you it for purposes of showing kind of the complexity, and we're going to talk about what that complexity means in a bit. But let me open up this video, and this one will be full screen.
Well, this is how a gene produces a protein. And I have a little animation to make this clear, because one picture here is worth a whole lot of my words. This is an animation of how the digital information in the DNA directs the construction of proteins.
In 1957, Francis Crick first proposed that chemicals called bases along the spine of the DNA molecule function as alphabetic characters in a written language, or digital characters in a machine code. This animation shows how this digital information directs protein synthesis. First, a large protein complex separates the tightly wound strands of the DNA to prepare it to be copied. During this process of transcription, a protein complex called a polymerase produces a single-stranded copy of the original instructions. Here we see this copy, a messenger RNA molecule, being constructed inside the polymerase as individual bases are added to the growing strand. Now we see the polymerase in action from the outside as it spits out the messenger RNA transcript. Next, this RNA transcript approaches and passes through a molecular machine called the nuclear pore complex, an information recognition device that controls the flow of information in and out of the cell's nucleus. Now we see the genetic assembly instructions on the messenger RNA approaching and arriving at a two-part chemical factory called a ribosome, the site of protein synthesis. As the messenger RNA transcript passes through the ribosome, the process of translation begins. During translation, a mechanical assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids in accord with the instructions on the transcript. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell by molecules called transfer RNAs, which link specific sequences of bases to corresponding amino acids. The sequential arrangement of the amino acids determines the type of protein constructed. When the construction of the chain is complete, it is often transported to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape required to perform its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is released into the outer cytoplasm to do its job in the cell.
So,
all right. You notice here, it was very, a lot of complex stuff going on. And you notice the language that Stephen Meyer was using. Digital information, instructions, transcription, translation. These are very specific terms that are also used within the biological academic realm. They use these words themselves, and it's going to become more and more important as we go on. But I believe we can see the deeper mystery coming about after seeing this brief video, which is the question, well, where did the information in the DNA come from? So you notice that how the DNA was unwound, and then these amino acids were coming up, and this protein was being created, and those letters in between the A, G, C's, and T's, that's the information. And he even mentioned that the specific arrangement of these letters and the specific arrangement of the amino acids was important for what kind of protein was actually going to be created as a result. And that's what we call information. We're going to get more in depth of what we mean by information, but we have to ask the question, where does this information in the DNA come from? That's what ID is trying to explain. All right. Here's a quote here for you that basically summarizes this issue. The problem of the origin of life is basically equivalent to the problem of the origin of biological information. And here's an analogy that may help you understand the issue. If I were to ask you guys, if you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? Give me your best guess. If you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it?
Program.
Program, instructions, anything else?
I have an app for that.
An app presupposes what? Information, right? You got to give it new code. You have to have a software engineer type of, okay, I want this to happen when this input arrives and I want to give this output. These are instructions, very specific code being written. And same thing in a biological level. If you want to build a new structure, a new physical structure from a pre-existing one, you need new proteins. You need new information in there. You need new lines of code in the DNA. So taking it further, if you want to get life going in the first place, i.e. build the first cell, you have to give an account of where the information came from, since DNA is essential to the function of a living organism. Now, it's at this point now that I want to clarify, we're going to define term another one, what kind of information we're talking about. So there's two concepts of information that are related to what we're talking about in this biological realm. One concept deals with mere improbability and complexity. And I'm going to try to do a little visual illustration here once more. Did the green one die for real? No, it's not that big a deal. Okay, let's see. I think because I left it out. Let's say I have a string of characters, okay? I have an L, wow, a T, an X, an H, okay, it's working, an H, a 5, a curly brace, a comma, an A, a Z, the number 6, you know, so on and so forth. Yeah. Don't copy this one. It's, let's see, how many characters is it long? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 characters long. This is a highly improbable, taken as a whole, it's a highly improbable string that would occur. It's improbable that out of all the possible combinations of alphanumeric characters that I could come up with, that these specific set of characters would have been chosen. So it's improbable, okay? 10-character string. It's also complex because it's pretty long. You know, if you create a password online, you know, these days they want you to have between an 8 and 12 and sometimes even 15 now length password. So this one's 10. It's pretty complex. Okay, if I were to just have two, the L and the T, it'd be improbable, but it wouldn't be that complex. Okay? So there's this combination of improbability and complexity that's in there. Now, this is known, this is called Shannon information. This is just the notion that this kind of information just tells you, gives you an explanation about the improbability of a certain kind of information that's being put forth. But this information, this kind of information, this Shannon information, it doesn't have anything to do with meaning or function. Anybody tell me what that means? Right? When we're trying to understand what it means, it really doesn't serve a purpose. It doesn't have any function in the real world. We can't use it really for anything. But this brings about a second concept of information. Now, how about this sequence of letters? Okay. It's obviously longer. It's more complex. It is still just, it's even more improbable because of its complexity. Right? So we're using the same characters, minus numbers and curly brace or whatever. But it still has this kind of information, improbability and complexity, but now it's what information theory is called. It has a property called specificity, that there is a specific sequence that I can put these characters in such that it now has a meaning. It now has a function. And this whole concept of specificity combined with complexity is what we call specified complexity. And this is actually the kind of information that is common. It is directly used in language and in software, computer software. It's specified. Think of a function when you write a software. You don't want to think of a function when you write, but think of language. When you're thinking of what words to use, you gather up the letters. I mean, this is all happening in real time and super, super fast. Just as fast as you can think, you speak it. But it's specified, and it's complex, and it's highly improbable. So when these three properties get together, you have what we have, specified complexity, and this is the kind of information that we see in DNA. And so it's not just similar to, the information found in DNA is not just similar to what we find in language or computer software. It is the same kind of information, and that just boggles my mind. But we're not going to be satisfied there just yet. We still have to answer the question, where does this kind of information come from? All right. Gold?
God.
Oh. I was like, gold? God. Interesting. Okay.
Alchemy.
And so now, yeah, alchemy, nice. Now that we have this knowledge in place, the difference between just regular improbability and complexity and then specified complexity, now with this knowledge in place, it's no surprise that many scientists in the biological realm, when they're studying, when they're looking at DNA and the inner workings of a cell, it's no surprise that they would be using language that is related to information theory. So Stephen Meyer was bringing up, right? Translation, transcription, instructions. This is the way that biologists, when they're looking at the inner workings of a cell, this is the way they talk when they're trying to relay the information or the results of a certain experiment. And so I think it's crazy and it's telling. And check out what Bill Gates said about DNA. He said, DNA is like a computer program, but we would say it is a computer or it is a program. And he says it's far more advanced than any we've ever created. So think of Bill Gates, founder of Windows. We have Windows 8.1 right now. Billions and billions of lines of code. They hired, I don't know, hundreds of engineers and software people to create Windows 8.1. And Bill Gates is saying DNA is just like Windows 8.1, but far more advanced than anything we've ever created. Wow. All right. So we're getting closer and closer to answering this question. Where did this information come from? Well, how can we explain this phenomenon? Throughout history, there have been alternative explanations, and they fit into one of three categories. And these three categories are random or chance process, right? We mentioned up in our original ideas about evolution, one of them was chance. That's the first one. The second one would be law or physical necessity. So something happens by just natural forces occurring. So that's law or physical necessity. And then the third would be a kind of a combination of both chance with physical necessity. So that's a combination of both. Well, let's start by taking a look at chance. Can chance explain the origin of information in DNA? An analogy to see how this plays out is found in the game Scrabble. And thank you to Edith and Larry who were generous enough to loan me this. So I have a bag filled with a bunch of Scrabble letters, right? And possibly, and more probably, that blank one. But never mind that. Now remember, we're talking about chance. Does chance have the capability of supplying the information in DNA? Now, it could be said that if you had enough time and if you actually had enough trials, perhaps you could randomly throw some letters out and they would fall into place. Okay, so let me try to grab what I think are 10 Scrabble letters here. It'd be awesome if it were 10. There's one. Okay, and I just randomly throw them out. Let's see what comes up. I'm trying to put them in place. Okay. All right. So let's see, I put these six in place. I have a B, a G, an E, an I, an A, and an N. Now, I don't know about you, but that is not really comprehensible. It doesn't really supply me with information. The argument could be made that there's a name Ian or something, right? But put together, this is highly improbable. Remember, it was improbable that I would pick exactly those sets of letters, and it's complex. I mean, it's long. We have 26 characters in the alphabet, and there's six going across, and so it's pretty complex. So, and one could argue, maybe I had enough trials, you know. Maybe let me do this 1,000 times. Let me keep throwing them out, okay? And Stephen Meyer, he has an anecdote where in his class, he would actually tell the students, okay, grab some, and every student would grab one and they would go and write the letter that they had on the board. And he says early on in the process, his students would start doing catcalls or whatever, because what happens is that they could form small words, maybe like cat or maybe dog or bee, ant, stuff like that. And they're like, oh yeah, we're proving you wrong. We got you. We got you, Meyer. But he would always win. Why? Just let the process go on. And what the students found out was, yeah, just give it maybe 10 trials and you would have something so unintelligible, it's not even worth noting. So he would always win because just give it enough time and random chance cannot produce this kind of information. Remember, we're not just looking for improbability and complexity. We have that here. We're looking for specific arrangement of letters that will bring about meaning and function. That's what we find in DNA. And so it seems to me then that chance won't do the job, but that's not it, because one could argue, well, if I really did have a super long amount of time, preferably infinite, but we talked about in a cosmological argument how we don't have that time, But they say, even since, if we had billions of years, we can see then how we can start developing at least a string of complexity and specified complexity if you just give me that time. And this is known as the problem of combinatorials, how it's possible to have a bring about a combination, a specific combination of letters. And here's where I want to show you another brief snippet of the video where Stephen Myers is actually explaining combinatorials much better than I could ever, so I'll play him for you.
Now, one of the things that contributed to this view among original life scientists was something called the combinatorial problem. There's a way of illustrating that with a simple device, a bike lock. If you think of the number of different ways of arranging the dials here, you realize that each one of these dials on the bike lock has 10 possible settings, and there are 4 dials. So the total number of possible settings is not 10 plus 10 plus 10 plus 10, but rather 10 times 10 times 10 times 10, or 10,000 possible combinations. Now shift the context a little bit. I had my graphic artist design this. I don't think there are locks like this, but given the crime rate these days, maybe it would be good to have. This is a bike lock with 10 dials. Now, again, the number of possible combinations and the odds, or probability rather, of finding the right combination by chance increases precipitously, exponentially. Now we have 10 times 10, 10 to the 10th power, 10 billion possible combinations. Now imagine you're a thief out in front of the hotel wanting to pick a lock like this. If you have just 30 seconds or a minute before the porters come out, is it more likely than not or less likely than not that you're going to find that correct combination by chance? Well, obviously, it's vastly more unlikely that you will find that than it is likely that you will find it. And now, the same thing ends up applying to the problem of generating even a single information-rich DNA or protein molecule by chance. I'll illustrate the principle with proteins. If you take just a short little section of a polypeptide, a short little section of amino acids with 10 sites, given that you have 20 possible amino acids that could attach in this growing chain at each site, you have 20 times 20 times 20 to the 10th power possibilities, which works out to 10 trillion possible combinations for a very short little section of polypeptide. Now, most proteins are many hundreds of amino acids long. The average protein is something around 300 amino acids. The protein, I have a colleague, Doug Axe, who's here with us tonight, who's done experimental work on very modest length proteins of a shorter length, about 150 amino acids. And if you begin to think about this mathematically, a very obvious problem arises for the chance hypothesis. If you have 150 sites with 20 possibilities at each site, you have 20 to the 150th power possibilities, which in base 10 computes to 10 to the 195th possibilities. So the odds of getting the probability of getting any particular sequence stands at 1 chance in 10 to the 195th. Now, we happen to know that there's some variability admitted at these amino acid sites. So the problem is not quite that severe. What Dr. Axe has done is investigate a very important question that arose in the 1960s as scientists were beginning to think about the probability of chance alone generating these large information-rich biomolecules. And the question was this: how rare or common are the functional sequences, functional proteins or information-rich DNA molecules, among all the possible combinations? If that group of 10 to the 195th is populated liberally with functional combinations, such that almost anything you try will give you a combination that will, by analogy, unlock the function.
Do you guys understand what he's saying there? They basically did an experiment where you're saying, let's only get the possibilities of amino acids that will work, not out of the entire range of amino acids. He's saying, let's only use the ones that will work, and let's see what the probabilities are.
Or perform a biological function, then chance alone might get the job done. But what Dr. Axe found was that the space of possible arrangements of amino acids, what mathematicians call a combinatorial space, was very extremely, I can't use enough adjectives, infrequently populated by functional combinations. He did some very careful sampling work called site-directed mutagenesis and showed that in the case of a very simple 150 amino acid long protein, the odds of getting correct sequencing were about 1 chance in 10 to the 77th power. Now, I won't go through all the math here. I do it in the book. But when you combine that insight with a number of the other factors that are relevant to computing the probability of generating a single protein by chance, including the important factor of the number of trials that you might have since the very beginning of the universe, you come to a startling result, and that result is this. That if every event from the beginning of the universe till now was devoted to searching for one of these functional combinations among all the possibilities, which is, again, a kind of an absurdly generous assumption, you would not have time to search more than about a trillionth of all the possibilities. A little tiny needle in a vast haystack the size...
Was a trillionth, 10 to the 12th plus 10 to the 12th, 10 to the 24th, and we're talking about 10 to the 195th. So that's how small that is.
The galaxy. And so as scientists began to grapple with this, to understand that it was vastly more likely that chance was false than it was true, that chance could get the job done rather than that it couldn't get the job done, they began to reject it and look for other approaches to the origin of information and the origin of life.
All right. So are there any questions about that? I think it's really, really clear that chance... what chance means is basically just the coincidence of certain events happening. It's undirected. So I think it's clear that chance alone cannot bring about this specified complexity, this information that we find in DNA, just by probability alone. And so, like he mentioned at the end there, is that scientists that are worth their degrees reject this hypothesis, this chance hypothesis. So if somebody tries to just tell you that chance is going to do the job, which you might find out in having evangelistic conversations with a layperson, you can tell them, no, the math does not add up. The probabilities just are not there. So I think we can scratch that one off the list. In fact, I'm going to write it here. I'll do this little square. It's going to come in handy in a little bit. So we have chance. We have law. And then we have chance plus law. And I'll leave that one. Oh, this is actually ID. Okay. So I think we can cross chance off. If anybody disagrees with me, I'll meet you out in the playground after this.
Playscape,
I mean. Good one. All right. So just like Scrabble, right? Let the process go on for long enough, you're not going to get that specified complexity. Now, interestingly enough, I think this difficulty, this combinatorial difficulty, would lead to the defeat of another popular argument or objection that is, I don't know how common it is actually today, but I'm certain a lot of us have heard it, where they say, well, if we just had an infinite amount of monkeys typing on a typewriter, banging away forever, they are bound to type out one of Shakespeare's writings, right? Well, immediately knowing what we know about from the cosmological argument, right, there's no such thing as infinite past or infinite time, okay? So that's already out. Secondly, we just showed how randomness is not good at building up large levels of complexity. It's good at getting small levels of complexity. Remember how you might get 3-letter combinations of words, ant, bee, stuff like that. But you let the process try to... the information that is required in DNA, we're talking about 300 sites here on average. The information required there is just enormous. And you cannot get that complexity from monkeys banging away on a typewriter. All right.
You could say it worsens, right? The longer you try, the worse.
Yep. The least competent it becomes. Good question. All right. So some scientists, in response, this is the second objection. We're looking at law and physical necessity. So some scientists have taken a Darwinian view to explain the information in DNA, which is actually, I correct myself, chance plus natural selection. So chance plus this physical necessity. And they say, working at a prebiotic level, working on the amino acids, I think we can generate this type of information. So you have a combination of the two, right? C plus L. However, the problem here is that it has to do with what you actually need to get natural selection going. There's certain requirements in order to have evolution start evolving in the first place. One of those is you have to have the ability, or an organism has to have the ability to reproduce, to make copies of itself. And this is the main one. Now, it assumes that living organisms can reproduce, and now you have, you know, a bunch of living organisms competing with one another. It assumes self-replication. In order to get self-replication, though, what do you need? You need DNA and proteins. These are the basic building blocks of life. And what's the problem with this? Well, this is precisely what we're trying to explain in the first place. We're trying to explain how the information got there, but natural selection already assumes that the information is present so that you can start replicating. So this is what's known as a circular argument. It's begging the question, and it doesn't get off the ground at all. It's assuming what it's trying to prove. So this hypothesis about chance plus natural selection is just not gonna cut it. At this basic fundamental level, it's circular reasoning. So I think we can cross that one off the board as well. Now, a third approach over the course of the years has been what we call self-organization or pure physical necessity or law. Something happens in a law-like process. For instance, gravity. Every time I hold an object, I let it go. The law of gravity says that this object will fall down at a certain rate. So this is a law-like process, and this is what some scientists have appealed to. Well, maybe the structure of the DNA on a chemical level is such that these letters, this information, has to be specified in a certain way. It must happen that way. So whenever these I'm gonna play a video and we'll see how the DNA is chemically composed, and he'll actually explain it. So let me stop talking and I'll actually bring it there. Let me talk a little bit more. This is actually a good illustration here. For instance, imagine salt crystals. In fact, I have a picture here. This is a salt molecule. Think of your regular table salt, these little crystals, right? How really tiny. This is what it looks like chemically. This is not a true picture, but you have a sodium element, and then you have the chlorine. And so sodium has, the Na has a positive charge, Cl has a negative charge. And guess what? Opposites attract, right? So whenever these guys are in close proximity, the law of gravity, you know, forces will always attract one another. And so these guys have a positive and a negative. This is not actually gravity, it's just magnetic. But so they're in close proximity, boom, they bond. And they bond in such a way that you have this complex structure. It's a crystal lattice, and it's highly improbable, but it's nature, forces of nature working on this, such that whenever you have these two elements in close proximity, it's just going to happen. And so the idea was that along the spine of the DNA is that you have, they believed that there were going to be certain kinds of bonds that had to happen at certain locations in the DNA. And that's what they were trying to explain. And I'll let Stephen Meyer take over.
And the idea, the problem was this. And I need to direct your attention to... good. It works.
Ours doesn't.
The structural formula for the DNA molecule. The pentagons and the sugars form what's called the backbone. And there's one on each side. The A's, C's, T's, and G's in these little boxes represent the nucleotide bases. Remember that it's the sequential arrangement of those bases that conveys the assembly instructions for building the proteins, for arranging the amino acids in the right way. Now, what they were trying to do was to explain the sequencing, why the arrangements are just the way they are, by reference to forces of chemical attraction. Now, notice that in the molecule, there are these, in the way we represent the structure, there are these little sticks. The sticks represent chemical bonds. Now, notice that there are chemical bonds between the sugars and the phosphates, chemical bonds between the sugars and the bases, but there are no chemical bonds between individual nucleotide bases. Now, this has a really powerful implication for their self-organizational model, because if there's no chemical interaction here, you can't invoke chemistry to explain the sequencing. You can't even invoke the attachment site here, because this bond is called an N-glycosidic bond, for people who are keeping track on their scorecards. This bond is the same in every case, so that at each site along the DNA chain, any one of the four bases can attach. It's chemically indeterminate. Any one of those bases can accept, or any one of those sites can accept any one of the bases. The chemistry, in other words, is not determining what attaches or the arrangement of the bases that attach to the medium. The message is here, the chemical message is here, the medium is here, but the chemistry is not determining the sequencing. When Kenyon realized this, he abandoned his whole self-organizational approach. I have a visual illustration, especially for people who aren't chemists. Forgive me. It's this structural formula of DNA to make a lot of sense. I've got a little message up here that combines some scientific terminology with American slang. The double helix rocks. All my students used to use rocks as a verb to say they liked something. Now, what we have here is a physical analogy to what's going on in the DNA molecule. In the DNA molecule, you have the backbone, the sugar phosphate backbone. It's not the message, but the medium upon which the instructions are inscribed. I have a medium as well, a backboard, a chemical or a magnetic chalkboard. The little tiny message I have here is also stuck to the backbone with a force of attraction. It's a magnetic force of attraction. But notice that magnetic force of attraction does not determine the arrangement of the characters in this little informational message. That's determined, well, Michael Polanyi, who first recognized this fact of DNA, said that the information was extrinsic to the physics and chemistry. It's coming from outside the physics and chemistry. Note that we can tell that the magnetism is not responsible for the information, because I can quickly rearrange things. We have all the same magnetic forces in play, but we have destroyed the specified information that was there originally. So this is what this helps, I think, understand what's going on in DNA. It's not the physics and chemistry that's determining the messaging. Moreover, if it were the physics and chemistry, it turns out that what you would end up with is not an information-rich sequence, but instead something that information theorists refer to as redundancy or simple repetitive order. If every time in that DNA molecule you got a T, you turned up a G along the spine, then what you'd end up with is a kind of repeating messages of TG, 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 TG. You get a molecular mantra, not a message, not an information-rich sequence that could direct protein synthesis. So both for empirical reasons and in principle theoretical reasons, scientists working on this self-organizational approach abandoned it. If it had been the case that self-organizing properties were responsible for the information in DNA, we would have been actually incorrect that it was informational. It would have been redundant order rather than specified complexity.
All right. That's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah.
So
he said there was like an outside force controlling the law of
the arrangement.
Right.
The arrangement.
And just like he was holding up that magnetic board,
right.
He was the one moving
driving it.
Right? He was the one putting the information in the way he wanted. So it's coming from outside of the structure itself. And so he says, when you have law, so if you had a certain bond that had to take place every time you had a certain molecule, you would see that repetitiveness. And it's true, just like we saw that crystal lattice, every time you see that bond, boom, and then another one comes, and it just forms this crystal. It's beautiful, it's complex, but it's repetitive, and it really gives no specified complexity. And just like you mentioned, people are abandoning this concept as well. And so we're kind of running out of ideas, and this, I think we can safely cross off law here. Yeah, dun dun dun. So now, we've seen how chance, necessity, and then a combination of two are unreasonable. We still must ask ourselves, is there any reason, is there any positive reason to believe that ID can provide a rigorous scientific explanation of the origin of information in the DNA molecule? Interestingly enough, and this is kind of cool, Darwin himself, Charles Darwin, gave us a clue as to how to approach the mystery. Now, again, don't look at me with heretical stares just because I use Darwin and we're going to rely on him a bit. But bear with me. Remember, in his theory of evolution by natural selection, he was attempting to explain events that occurred in the remote past. So he's saying, how do we explain what we see now? And what these fossils seem to represent, there seems to be a progression, right? He's trying to explain an event in the remote past. It's not repeatable, right? He pioneered this method, this scientific method called inference to the best explanation. And you guys might recall from the logic class what an inference is. It's kind of like an inductive argument. You don't have all of the information, but you have multiple competing hypotheses, and you make an inference as to what the best explanation is. You're trying to say, I believe that this cause or this explanation provides the most amount of information that we need to say that this is what caused this event. So it's naturally comparative. So you have multiple competing hypotheses, and when you look at the broad scope of evidence, you say, I'm making an inference to the best explanation. So remember, it's a modest claim. It's not saying proof. It's not proving this is the one. It explains everything. No, it's saying this is the best explanation. And if we get new evidence that we have to change our thought process, then so be it. But for now, this explains the information the best manner. And of course, the question becomes, well, what constitutes the best explanation? How do we know when a cause is the best? And I said, interestingly enough, Charles Darwin and his mentor, Charles Lyell, the father of the geological column, they used this simple common sense reasoning. And it goes like this. If you're trying to infer events in the remote past, you should infer a cause which is known to produce the event or effect you are trying to explain. So he's saying you don't want to appeal to a cause that nobody knows about and it's not in operation. In fact, Lyell said you should refer to causes now in operation or presently acting causes. And I'll give you an example. I'll ask you, how do we go about explaining the city and people of Pompeii being covered in ash? Well, we can come up with multiple hypotheses. Maybe an earthquake occurred and just spit up all this ash and it covered the people. Well, how about a volcano? Maybe this volcano erupted and a bunch of ash came along with it and it covered them, leaving them in their place. Well, we have multiple competing hypotheses, but we know from our presently occurring causes that volcanoes produce ash. And lo and behold, there was a volcano nearby. And so now we have an inference to the best explanation. We inferred from causes now in operation. We know a volcano is known to produce the event in question, which is a bunch of ash. So that's the way it would kind of play out. And this is what Charles Darwin, this is the scientific method he used in actually proposing the theory of natural selection, because oddly enough, the theory of natural selection was not well accepted in the beginning. And he wrote to a colleague of his explaining, well, this is the method I'm going about. It seems to me if we have multiple competing hypotheses, we're going to choose the one that best explains the evidence. And until another better explanation comes along, I think we're reasonable in holding this conclusion. And it makes intuitive sense. And I think we're allowed to make those conclusions ourselves, especially when it comes to explaining the origin of information in DNA. So now the question becomes, what is the cause now in operation, the cause that we know from our uniform and repeated experience, another phrase of Lyell, that produces information? It seems to... Sure. What is the cause now in operation that produces information? And it seems to me that from our ordinary experience, as well as scientific experience, as we've been seeing, that there is only one such cause, and that is intelligence. There can only be one. You guys seen Highlander? No?
There can only
be one. Yeah. Love it. All right. It seems to me that intelligence in our normal experience, we always, always observe intelligence bringing about this kind of information, specified, complex information. And it is always brought about by a mind, an intelligence. An information theorist is known to have said, the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. And I think we can all agree on this. Think about all the things we see in here. The software in a computer. How does new software get released? Well, conscious agents, intelligent agents, sit around at a table and they code up a bunch of software. They create new information to bring about new programs. So, again, the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. And think about it. Look at newspaper headlines. Every day they're new, they're updated. Hieroglyphic inscriptions, a section of software, as I mentioned. We always trace this back to a mind. When we look at a newspaper headline, we don't trace it back to a material experience. Oh, something happened at the printing press and, you know, this just came out. This newspaper just came out from the printing press. I don't know how it happened, but that's today's news. No, a mind wrote that, printed that out. It's actually the information, right? Not the medium. So when we find information in the DNA molecule, the specified complex, information that is not similar, but just like the information we see in language and programming, the logical thing to conclude using this scientific method pioneered by Darwin himself is that intelligence played a role in the origin of this information. So it seems then that we can, in fact, build a rigorous scientific theory of the origin of information in DNA using the method of inference to the best explanation. So here we have our little square, and it seems that we've ruled out all the popular ones, these three categories, but we have this lone ranger here, intelligent design, and it seems to best explain what we observe, the information in DNA. And that, my friends, is the intelligent design argument. Okay? How much time do we have left? We got a few minutes. And what I wanted to do with the time that we have left is go over some objections. They're listed in your study guide. We won't go over all of them today, but there is one that was relevant, and I brought it up in the beginning of the study because... It was the question, well, if the evidence does point in the direction of a designer, of an intelligent agent producing this information in DNA, if we have the evidence, then why do some reject it? That was what I brought up. Remember I mentioned that I can probably change people's minds about their definition of evolution, but yet they won't side with there being an intelligent agent behind it. And I mentioned because I believe there's more at hand. There's another factor in play. And let me answer that objection. I think it's the last one on your study guide. What is the last question on the study guide, by the way?
ID is not science. We cannot allow supernatural explanation.
There you go. ID is not science. And here's the kicker. We cannot allow supernatural explanations. And that is not a scientific statement. That is a philosophical statement. So it's not that they have a problem with the evidence, the scientific evidence. It's that there's an underlying philosophical assumption. Remember we were talking about worldviews, the very first class? There's a worldview problem at play. Okay, a person's worldview does not allow for extranatural or supernatural causes. This is popularly known as materialism or naturalism. Materialism / naturalism is basically the view that nature or matter is all there is, that the universe is a closed system. Nothing new can come in. So obviously this means that there can be no supernatural agent outside of the universe coming in and monkeying around with things. Nature and matter is all there is. Obviously, if this is your going assumption, if this is your basic presupposition, this is your basic assumption, and this is how you're going to start off by when you're doing science experiments and when you're trying to find answers, then you're forced to explain those things using only matter and nature. It's just logical. You're basically, think of a tool set. You know, you have all the tools that you need to build a structure, but if you're missing one necessary tool that is necessary to get the job done, it's probably the most crucial tool that you need, but it's outside of your toolbox.
It's always Beckett's
shop. Yeah. Then you're not gonna be able to completely finish that project. And the same thing here. Of course, if you're not gonna let a supernatural explanation just by assuming that there's no supernatural explanation, of course, you're never going to get to that point. But that's the problem here. People can easily and adamantly reject ID out of hand. It's just not possible given their worldview. Now, we've shown so far how the material alternatives are not viable, yet scientists seem to still be holding out for a material explanation. They say, oh, it's going to come. We just have to give it time. Science is always changing. We're going to get that knowledge one day. Well, take the words of a famous scientist, and this is going to answer the question, why do some people reject it? This is a famous scientist named Richard Lewontin, and he says this. Unfortunately, I can't repeat it because it's super long, but I can give you the notes. He says, we take the side of science in spite of the patent. Well, let me back up. When he says science, by the way, he means naturalism, natural explanations. Okay? He doesn't mean the scientific method in general that we all use, even as Christians. He means naturalism. We take it in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for an unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanation, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Here's the kicker. Moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. We cannot allow it.
What year did he write that?
I'm not
dead
sure.
Or is he alive?
Oh, that I'm not sure of, but I can look that up for you. I want to say he's alive, because I've been seeing his name pop up. But this is the going assumption for many in the science, in the academic realm. Granted, we do have plenty. There's a growing number of Christian scientists and Christian philosophers. But this is, I think, a big reason why, even though all of the natural explanations so far have failed, that we still see people rejecting this idea of ID without even looking at it. They say, it's not science. It's not science. I'm not going to allow any supernatural or extra-natural explanation at the very outset. That's my assumption. And now, hopefully as you, how you would respond to that objection is you would ask them, well, why assume supernatural is out of the picture right off the bat? And I would leave it to you to think a little harder about that and answer that on your own. How would you go about explaining how it is actually viable and actually necessary to include extra-natural or supernatural causes? So I just wanted to throw that bit in there, is why do people reject it? But that is the intelligent design argument, guys.